Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. For tonight's cast, I am speaking to Linden Lab. They are the developers behind the very popular game Second Life, and they have recently launched another title, Blocks World. And what's interesting about these two games, of course, beyond just their social popularity, is how Linden Lab also allows content creators to monetize or get profit from the content they create with both their titles. And we're going to be talking to them tonight about both the development as well as this kind of philosophy. So, please welcome from Linden Lab, first CEO, Ebbe Altberg.
Hello.
And head of marketing, Peter Gray.
Hello.
Peter, Ebbe, it's great to have you on tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it.
Not a problem. Linden Lab has definitely been around for a long time. I know you guys were founded back in 1999, and Second Life was pretty much started like right around then, wasn't it?
It took a few years to get the first version out, but year number 13 for Second Life is coming up in June, so it's into its second decade.
Impressive. We're especially coming from the early thousands. We saw kind of an MMO bust over the last few years, and only a few major names have remained, like Second Life, and of course the big one, World of Warcraft.
Yeah, League of Legends, and there's some good ones out there, but we're the only one that is, all the content is 100% created by the users, And the only platform that allows people to monetize the content and experiences and businesses they do inside of Second Life.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. Now, this kind of platform or allowing people to monetize their content, was that always a part of Second Life or did that come later into the game's lifespan?
The marketplace and the ability for people to exchange goods and services came a few years in. We're pretty much a decade into operating an exchange where people can buy and sell and trade on the platform.
Yeah. And as we're going to be talking about later tonight, that is definitely a very interesting marketing strategy for games. For those of you who listened to the cast before, earlier in 2015, we talked about the Steam Workshop and their attempt to monetize mods. But with Second Life and now Blocks World, you guys are definitely one of the first developers to go around rewarding content creators for what they produce.
Yeah, and they reward themselves.
Yeah.
It's ultimately the transactions within Second Life are between users. It's not them buying stuff from us or creating stuff for us to sell. They create stuff. Whether it's content, experiences, businesses, services in Second Life, between each other. And we're really just a platform that enable them to transact within the world. And last year alone, creators of content and services and businesses in Second Life redeemed about $60 million. For a lot of people, this is a significant source of income. So we love the fact that users can sort of explore creating experiences and profit from it. So this is something that's really built into how we do everything we do.
Yep, interesting. Before we talk more about Second Life and monetizing content, since this is the first time you guys are on the cast, for people listening who may not have heard of Linden Lab or may have been following you guys, could you talk a little bit about the background of the studio just to catch everyone up on?
Yeah, so like you said earlier, it started in 99. Second Life came about in the
2003.
So it took about 3-4 years to get the first version of Second Life up and running. And since then, it's been a very close relationship with the residents of Second Life who create all the content on top of the platform. And we continually spend time to create the tools and the platform in order for them to be able to create experiences on top of it. So inside of Second Life, you have a huge number, tens of thousands of distinct experiences, ranging subject matter from education to health to role playing to art and entertainment, live music shows. And people socialize around these experiences that are created by users and either find similar passions to engage with other users around fashion or education. It's almost as varied and complex as the physical world we live in. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everything that people like to do is being done inside of Second Life. And
That open-endedness is partly why we generally don't refer to Second Life as a game, because while some users have created games inside the virtual world, it really is much more open-ended than that, and there isn't sort of a common goal or levels to grind through or sort of manufactured conflict. It's really an open social platform where users can create content and experiences that they can then experience with other people around the world, and also monetize, as we've been talking about.
Yeah, so it's more akin to the physical world we live in. We don't really call our lives games. Mm-hmm. There are games within our lives, whether you're going to a bowling alley or an arcade or something like that. So those things all exist within Second Life, but there's also a lot of just, you know, living life and socializing and meeting friends and listening to music and, you know, the things we do in the physical world, we also do in the virtual world.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you brought up the fact that Second Life is not really a quote-unquote game peer, because, again, I think that's really what's helped led to its longevity compared to the other MMOs that were on the market during the last decade. As we talked about earlier with games like World of Warcraft and League of Legends, they really became the kings of the hill for their respective genres. And a lot of developers tried to chase after them with similar designs and mechanics, and ultimately those games either never got the audience that they needed to stay alive, or they sort of died down to a very limited market. But with Second Life, by the fact that it is more of like the social platform, it definitely has helped, I think, to keep it not only popular, but to keep people coming back to it and, again, creating this unique content for the game.
Yeah. At the core there is the social aspects, and that people can create things together, experience things together, living interesting lives in there and discovering new friends and new passions and find other people that share your passions. Mm-hmm. And you can also go in there with lots of different types of skills and add value to the whole thing. Maybe you're a great scripter, maybe a great storyteller, maybe you're a great social coordinator. And all of these different roles can have value within a Second Life. You don't just have to be the one that can shoot monster faster than the other guy. I mean, there's a huge variety of skills and that contribute to the overall value of Second Life.
Yeah. And obviously none of that is like considered like abstract, like no one's building up programming points or art points. It's basically the person's dedication to the platform and their own creativity and imagination that they can use to create whatever content that they would like.
Yeah, we don't score you, we don't level you, although there are plenty of games inside of Second Life that, you know, you score and win, and but those are just like, you know, I liken it to going into a bowling alley and having a competition, and then you walk out of the bowling alley, you're no longer in that game, you're just in the world, right?
And certainly, you know, as you see in the physical world, creators in Second Life and personalities in Second Life do build up their own reputations. You know, people become known as, you know, wonderful fashion designers, or known as very talented scripters, or known as great community organizers, for example. So they certainly still amass a sort of reputation with their identity. But it's not something that's sort of a point system controlled by us, the platform provider.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this reminds me, a few weeks ago, or probably a few months ago, for those of you listening to this cast, I spoke with Jimmy Madigan, who does like It's called Psychology of Games, where he talks about the psychological motivators behind people playing video games. And we talk specifically about MMOs and the social aspect and how that can be a huge factor beyond just someone playing a game for experience, for loot, that kind of thing. And Second Life definitely hits that social aspect, as both of you were just talking about.
Yeah, which I think also why it's so interesting to educate mm-hmm. and researchers. I mean, you have people inside of Second Life been researching over the years the psychology of a virtual world. Anthropologists mm-hmm. have been doing work inside of Second Life, understanding how communities form, and mm-hmm. So it's definitely way more complex. I mean, games oftentimes are about narrowing down your options,
yeah,
and making the goal at any one point very specific. Whereas Second Life is extremely open-ended, and it is really the motivation is behind the individual to choose mm-hmm. to do, where to go, who to interact with. Which, you know, they're not saying one is better than the other mm-hmm. in certain contexts, but we're definitely the most experienced with such an open-ended, user-created world where users can profit from what they do.
Yeah. And the level of ingenuity and creativity in Second Life, it reminds me to some extent how Minecraft started to blow up in the early, like, 5-6 years ago, when people were starting to dig into that and build mods and, again, build sort of like games within games, content within content. But with Second Life, obviously, I think that is a much greater scale, much greater variability.
Yeah, the variety of use cases with mm-hmm. Second Life, I think, is almost similar to the physical world we live in.
Yeah.
Whereas Minecraft is more narrow. But then Minecraft is also, you could argue, on average, easier for anyone to create something. Mm-hmm. In Second Life, it takes a little bit more sophistication and skill to build a successful experience. But then those experiences can also be much more immersive and engaging, and also really solving real-world problems for a lot of people. I mean, you have universities teaching subjects in Second Life. I mean, Texas A&M teaching chemistry in Second Life. You have mm-hmm. health professionals treating all kinds of phobias or post-traumatic stress disorders in Second Life. And you have musicians performing in Second Life and making a living performing where they otherwise couldn't afford to travel the world and perform live in front of their fans. So mm-hmm. you don't see those kinds of things happening in Minecraft. So it's, I would say there, you know, there's some similarities, but there's also some very, you know, broad differences.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's another thing, again, that makes Second Life stand out so much compared to other games, by the fact that the content that we're seeing, not only is it 100% original, but it's also 100% unique to these individuals. As you were saying a few minutes ago regarding there are actual musicians in Second Life who compose original content, not original content so much that's linked to Second Life, but actual original songs that, again, build their brand, build their presence, and that, again, feeds back into the social aspect. And as you guys have been saying over the last few minutes, making Second Life be, well, literally like a second life for a lot of people.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, for some people, maybe because of where there are geographic constraints or physical or other reasons for why it might be difficult for someone to go out and go to a concert, they can go and experience live music with their friends and family in Second Life, where maybe they don't actually even have that option in the physical world. So it's very liberating for a lot of people because of who they can be, what they can do, where they can go, which, you know, it's sort of, for some people, it makes it a more interesting place to be than the physical space. But mm-hmm. It's definitely adding a lot of value, which is why we have such a tremendously strong core set of users or residents, as they're referred to. Who can have very long, I mean, I meet people in Second Life that have been on the platform for 10 years and still absolutely love working inside the medium and with their friends and colleagues.
And people who have met, you know, very dear friends and formed, mm-hmm. you know, super important relationships to them, whether it be friendship or, you know, we even have couples that have gotten married in the physical mm-hmm. world after first meeting in Second Life, because they have, you know, these long-standing social relationships with people where they're actually getting to do things together, you know, go to a concert together like you would offline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that ease of accessibility, I think, is also a major component, not just of Second Life, but really of the growing video game market, especially how it exploded over the last decade. You guys were talking about people with mobility issues, geographical issues. I mean, I have a bad leg myself, so I can't, you know, go out into the world like anyone else can. But with the use of internet, with the use of these greater accessibility tools, people like me can talk to people. I mean, the whole use of Game Wisdom in these podcasts is a clear example of that, just like it is with a game like Second Life, and being able to forge these relationships and, again, have this community that you wouldn't get if you were just limited to the real world.
Yeah. I mean, it's extremely powerful communication platform for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I would say some people need it. You know, they don't just want it, you know, for fun, but it's a critical component of their physical and mental well-being is to be part of this. I mean, we have wonderful examples of people that who has made a tremendous difference in their lives. I mean, we have, you know, Fran, who is in the upper 90s, who has Parkinson's, who is therefore, you know, very challenged in what she can do in the physical world, who in Second Life can go dancing with friends, she can go swimming, she can go mm-hmm. running, she can go exploring, she can socializing. And she's even finding that doing all these activities in the virtual world actually improves her physical well-being, because her brain is mm-hmm. actively performing all these things that normally wouldn't be possible for her in the physical world. So yeah. It's extremely powerful in that sense.
Definitely. And we see the same thing with just how much video games have helped enrich a lot of lives. Again, with people who would never be able to do these things in real life, be it mobility issues, anything else, personal issues like that. And being able to enjoy these things, again, and with Second Life as being this platform, you guys were talking about a few minutes ago, with people actually running like educational courses and doing these things within this platform, is just an amazing example of what can be done with, I guess, video games as being more of a social platform beyond just the, I guess, quote-unquote, gaminess of like a traditional video game.
Yeah, there's you know, obviously technologies are similar, and mm-hmm. some of the challenges of creating these scalable MMO platforms has a lot of similarities, but creating a specific game with specific purpose versus a general platform also has a lot of very different challenges that yeah. dealt with for a long time. What is appropriate content? What is legal content? What is how do you create an environment where the creators of these experiences can be successful and in creating communities and monetizing the work they do and having successful relationships with other users on the platform, just has a lot of unique challenges that we've dealt with for a long time, and we'll continue to do as we will build other platforms going forward and continue to enhance Second Life as well.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. This may be a bit too big specifically for this podcast, but if you could just talk a little bit more about, I guess, developing the community aspect of the game. Obviously, you have a wide range of ages and people playing the game. I know, as you said, we can have everything from simple games, stuff for kids, to things for adults, and more mature content. As someone, as a developer or studio that is working on developing this as a community, how do you go about, how did you make that decision between, you know, what someone can do in Second Life versus something that they can't do in the title?
Well, I mean, we do have community guidelines for what is appropriate behavior to just be a, you know, a decent human being
yeah.
Amongst other people in a social platform. And then there's also laws, you know, local and you know, federal and international laws that we have to abide by. So there's certain things that you just cannot do. You can't operate a casino, for example, certainly not in most states or country.
Yeah.
We have to make sure that the content that users create and the way they try to monetize their content and experiences, you know, abide by those rules. So in some ways we do operate like, you know, the feds and, you know, we also have to do some policing to make sure that people behave appropriately and to find sort of the, you know, we don't want to be too controlling of what you can and cannot do. We want to provide maximum amount of freedom for what people want to express and do, but just want to make sure that it's also a healthy, safe and legal platform in all ways. And because people can convert our virtual tokens to actual real money in the tune of $60 million just last year alone, we also have to do a lot of compliance work and make sure there's no money laundering or any of those kinds of things going on. So we have a tremendous amount of experience when it comes to running a very open, free world and at the same time manage what is and what is not appropriate.
And I think talking more about the monetization or people redeeming their, what's the, I guess, the type of, the name of the currency in Second Life that people can transfer to real money?
The tokens you can basically buy are called the Lindens, and it's running off an exchange where users basically buy and sell Lindens amongst each other. We're basically just providing the platform where users basically exchange Lindens and fiat currencies amongst themselves.
Interesting. And I know not too many online titles have gone the route having almost a analog to a real-world economy in their titles. The only other game that comes to my mind would be like what they've done with EVE Online over the years and having its own real-world translation of the currency there. And I know when you go that route, as you guys were just saying, it can lead to a lot more challenges, a lot more loops you need to jump through in order to make sure everything remains legal and legitimate for everyone involved.
Absolutely. I mean, compliance is a very high priority for us and has been for a long time. So understanding how all the regulations and legalities around this is obviously something that we probably have more experience than most in doing, but which is absolutely critical and core to us because we do have the belief that the only way to really create scalable, call it a metaverse of tremendous scale, where ultimately not one company can create the content for everybody else to consume. We believe that in order for it to have the variety and the interest, it has to be user created and users have to profit or benefit from the content experiences and services they provide. So therefore, it's absolutely core to us to make sure that that's a very smooth and safe and legal aspect of our business. So, you know, I refer to us having four core products. It's Second Life. It's Blox World, which we'll touch on in a bit. We're working on a huge new project called Project Sansar for use and sort of a next generation platform for user-driven content that will also work tremendously well on in VR and all kinds of HMDs. And then I would say compliance is sort of our fourth product, the services that goes with that.
Interesting. And talking more about developing a analog to a real world economy and the challenges and constraints with that, I would love to talk to you guys more about that. I think that may be a little bit too off topic for this specific cast, but in the future, if you guys have any more free time, I would love to dedicate another cast specifically to that development of the Lindens and the economy of the game.
That would be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. But let's move on and talk a little bit more about the monetization or allowing content creators to get reward. Because that is something, again, that Second Life was one of the first games or first platforms to really allow that. But we're seeing more of a push for that in recent years. And then from there, we'll talk about Blox World, and that should take us to the end of the cast. So, with monetizing created content, this has been another one of those very interesting things that we've seen really develop over the last few years. For those of you listening to this cast, again, back in, you know, the 90s and early 2000s, people create original content that was either locked to that game or it had no monetary value specifically to that person. If someone wanted to create a mod to a popular game, it would earn them some recognition, maybe it could lead to a job, but in terms of actually, you know, applying a price tag to that and getting paid for it, that wasn't going to happen. Last year, of course, the Steam Workshop took a step forward to allow people to monetize any kind of mods or Steam Workshop content on Elder Scrolls Skyrim, and that kind of blew up in their faces. And we could, that talking about that is a little bit too big for this topic, but it does lead into this discussion about content creators getting rewarded for their hard work. I mean, Patreon is an example. I mean, I use Patreon for GameWisdom, and with Second Life itself, as we were saying, people can buy and sell linens, and then that can be translated into real-world dollars. So, with this kind of economy, with getting people to get reward for their own content, how did you guys come up with that decision to essentially allow people to earn a living off of Second Life?
Well, for starters, I mean, early on, it was not necessarily a decision up front. It was something that was put in a couple of years in of the platform. But the idea basically being that the content had to be user-generated from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the decision that people should be able to profit a benefit from that, because it's very hard to get interesting content if everybody's just doing it for free. And it was done early enough that it wasn't retrofitted. I mean, companies are starting to reward users for doing some content production. That's almost more akin to outsourcing the content creation, which is very different from actually letting the users choose what content to create and profit from, and also the variety of it's not just creating certain aspects for a certain game and getting, you know, so for us, it's not a retrofitted thing to try and scale basically your art department at a cheaper cost, which is how some games approach it. And I think that's going to be difficult to make into a big business. I think it, if it's an inherent part of the platform that users can benefit from this, then you're going to see a much more sophisticated creator gravitate to the platform and create more sophisticated experiences. And you also get the competition of so many different users creating things that, you know, quality starts to rise to the top. Supply and demand sorts itself out for what types of content is valued. Just the creative aspects of, we could never even imagine or guess what users will do when you give them the tools to express themselves. And we are continually surprised with the things that appear on the platform that we never could have imagined ourselves. And so that's, it's kind of something that's just built into the core of how we think about things. We are a platform company where all the content is created by the users, and whether that's Second Life, Blox World, or Project Sansar, that's how we go about things. And you just end up thinking about solutions in a very different way when that's a core way of doing business as opposed to just an add-on.
Yeah. And I think you made two really great points there, Abby, regarding making this attractive to content creators. I think the first one, and that's very important, is that it was built from the ground up as a part of Second Life. This wasn't something that was added, you know, 7-8 years into the game's development. As you were saying, it didn't have to be retrofitted into the experience. And that allows people to create things from the ground up. One of the issues I think they had with the Skyrim was the fact that the game was already out and, you know, fully developed with a mod community long before they attempted to do this kind of monetization. So again, that retrofit led to things just not working. And I think the second point you made that was also really important is the fact that this is all original content that's not limited by the scope of the title. Like, again, if you're developing kind of for a first-person shooter, you can create, you know, original music. You're limited to what the modding tools and what works within the confines of that system. But, again, with something like Second Life, where you are free to do anything literally within the title itself because there is no limitation, it allows people to have a much greater pool to draw from when they're coming up with their content. Again, we spoke earlier, people are coming up with original songs, original venues, educational courses, studying things that, again, you would never see that in a game that was already pre-established with a constrained system.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's our strength, but also part of sort of the challenge is that it's hard to explain what Second Life is because it's such completely different things to different people. Mm-hmm. For some people, it's a classroom. For some people, it's a game. For some people, it's a creative outlet for art. For some people, it's and that's why it's almost as, you know, it becomes as complex as explaining what's the purpose of planet Earth to people versus, you know, what's the purpose of this very specific game. It's easier for me to explain chess than it to explain life because it has a set of rules and a set of boundaries. And that's that sort of makes it difficult because there is no one way to explain Second Life to all users because a lot of different users have get something of value out of Second Life for a lot of different reasons. So it's a challenge, but it's also a strength. So that's,
Now, one thing that I'm curious about, since we are dealing with digital goods and services, if, let's say, someone creates a unique piece of clothing for Second Life and they sell it, if someone buys that specific clothing, are they allowed to essentially mass produce it on their own, or does the content and the rights of distribution remain to the original content creator?
So that is up to the original content creator. The original content can create content that they say, you know what, you can do whatever you want with this, and you can create derivative works off of it as you wish, or they can constrict what you can do with it. They can sell you something that you can't copy. They can sell you something that you can't modify. They can say you can copy and modify as you wish. And that sort of depends on the creator and their business model and what they prefer and whether... but the creators basically have a choice in how their content can be used or modified or reproduced.
Yeah, and I think that is a very smart decision, a very wise one on your guys' part of having those rules and having those options. Going back again to when Steam allowed the monetization of Skyrim, that led to a very ethical quandary of, if someone creates something for free and then someone decides to use that to monetize, you know, what happens to that original content? Who owns the rights to it, et cetera, et cetera? But again, I think going back to what we were just saying, seeing as how this was a major component of Second Life and you guys built this along with the platform, it again allows both the strengthening of the platform and providing the protection for those content creators. Because without that protection for someone creating content, then it doesn't matter what they create if they can't, you know, make use of it to the extent of their abilities.
Yeah, and we're probably the only one that have sort of given the basically full rights to the creators of their content. I mean, we certainly need to have access to some of those rights as well because we need to render these things. We need to be able to copy them for the platform. And we also need to be able to remove them if they cross the line for, you know, some legal reason or something. But it is really that all the content belongs to the users that created it.
Yep. And again, Second Life is one of the first games to really, or one of the first platforms to really make use of that. So this next question, I'm not sure if you guys can fully answer or not, if you don't want to give your opinion, but I'm just wondering, when you guys heard of the Skyrim monetization and Steam trying to get in on this workshop, as people who have been specializing in this for so long, what did you think of like another developer trying to, I wouldn't say go along the same lines as Second Life, but trying to sort of ease into that same kind of marketplace?
Well, obviously, we're huge believers in it. So I'm expecting that over time, there will be more and more and more of this type of a business model of platforms that allow creators, you know, various degrees of freedom of what they can create and how they can, you know, benefit from what they create. So it's not surprising to me to see companies doing this. And we have some interesting technology and services that ultimately will also benefit third parties that want to do this. Because there's a lot of special sauce that we have that it's going to be really difficult, both from technically and from compliance and legal side of things, to be able to do what we do, especially when you get to the ability for users to actually redeem kill currency for the work they've done. And so some of the work we're thinking about for the future is to actually allow our core service for doing that stuff to be available to third parties as well. So we're believers, and yes, we're going to see more and more companies doing this. You know, some will do it basically because they think of it as a, the issue of content production is comes with a high cost.
Yeah.
Which I see some companies, I say, think of it as outsourcing the content creation at a lower cost than would take for them to produce it in-house. That is, I think, is going to have some, you know, it'll have some success and it'll be beneficial to some users. Mm-hmm. And then others will, you know, approach it more like we are, and some other games too. I mean, like we said, we have Blox World, and soon Project Sansar will do similar things, but you also have other products like Roblox, et cetera, that are really leaning towards a much broader set of content that users can create and benefit from that. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if we will see more and more companies sort of start to go down the path or similar path to what we've been doing for quite a while.
Yeah, I think that is a smart move to lend your services and provide the information resources to third parties. One of the things that we've seen a lot, especially with the free-to-play and social boom in the last few years, are developers trying to translate real-world money to their virtual currencies. And again, when going from real money to, you know, premium currency, that's simply a transaction. But when you're giving when you're giving people the option of taking money out of the game into the real world, that opens a completely different web of challenges and constraints, especially with the legality of it, as we've talked about a few points during this cast.
Yeah, and that's something we're experts at, you know, technically and legally and policy and everything that goes around it. That's a non-trivial problem for others to try and solve. So hopefully, you know, not too distant future, you know, companies will be able to talk to us about how to leverage some of the work we've done in that area.
One other question that I have regarding the transferring of Lindens to real-world currency has to do with how people, I guess, essentially make their money off of Second Life. One of the other factors we saw with the Steam Workshop and how Steam and Bethesda handled it was the split between the developer or the owner of the property versus the content creator, the person making this original content. A lot of people felt that it was skewed against the content creator. With Second Life, again, I'm not sure if you can give me exact numbers. If not, that's all right. But how does, I guess, the financial side gets split between Linden Lab and the actual person making this content and selling it on the platform?
Yeah. So you obviously, this is kind of like, how do you decide that a society is going to be taxed and what fees you have? In Second Life, we actually have what I would say kind of extreme on this one. Most of the cost for users in Second Life, or how we collect money, is actually mostly on the hosting side of things. To basically have your creation running on our simulators, you have to pay money to basically have us host your simulator, or land, as it's called. Mm-hmm. The GDP in Second Life, which is around, you know, just north of $500 million, we tax not at all, really. And if you put your content in our marketplace where people can search it and find it and buy it, although you can also buy and sell directly in world without going through the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But if you sell on the marketplace, it's a very low fee, 5% today.
Okay.
So being a just a content creator, let's say I'm, you know, there's a guy in Second Life that's the tree guy. If you want cool trees for your whatever you want to create, you go to the tree guy and you get trees from him. Mm-hmm. And he can sell those trees in his in-world store at with zero tax, or put them on the marketplace for a 5% tax. Mm-hmm. But he has to, you know, if he owns land, he has to pay quite a bit.
Okay.
In Project Sansar, we're actually thinking about, we want to lower the fees of the hosting of your sim or your land. But that means we have to collect the money elsewhere, which means we'll have to take a bigger piece of the GDP, or basically the transaction between users, whether those are for services or for content or experiences. So we'll increase those fees and basically try and get, you know, a more better balance, because right now we think land is too expensive in Second Life. Mm-hmm. And the fees we collect on content and service transactions is too low. So Project Sansar will have cheaper land, but more taxation or fees on the transactions of content and services. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, you know, you even see states in America, you know, competing on, you know, whether you have state income tax or what have you. And some people prefer to live in certain states, or businesses prefer to live in certain states because of, or certain countries because of the taxation scheme or the fees that it costs to run a business. So this is something that we have a lot of experience playing with, and we're going to try it to do it. We're going to do it a bit differently in Project Sansar, but in general, I would say that the virtual economy for virtual goods, whether it's music or other types of IP, is starting to settle around 30%. You know, some of these companies that are more outsourcing their content creation, where it's more restrictive, I've seen as, you know, taking as much as 70%, only giving 30% to the creators. We don't think it could ever go that far and be successful. You just can't tax the original content creation at that level and get away with it. I'm not sure where the music industry is at, but that is probably a very high tax. I mean, if you think about how much does the original content creator get for the music they produce, and I think that's sort of unsustainable in the long term.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of finding the right balance that, A, allows us to provide all these tools and the platforms and all the services around this and the compliance and all that, and make sure that we can get enough money to have a healthy business, but also make sure that the people that create content and service on the platform can get a positive return on their investment. So it's a matter of getting the balance between all these components right, so that you have a thriving content and service ecosystem, as well as, you know, the original platform provider like ourselves can have a sustainable business.
Yeah.
And a lot of that gets back to just the basic philosophy that Evan was talking about earlier, where we want to empower creators, we want them to be successful, and we want to share in that success. You know, it's not, we want to, you know, we guess it'll sort of be okay for them to maybe create some content on the side as a sort of add on to our business. It's, no, this is core to what we're doing.
Yeah, we will only be successful if our creators are successful. Yeah. That's how we set up our thinking from the get-go. Mm-hmm. If the users can't be successful, then we'll fail together. If we can make them successful, then we'll get more creators creating more content and better experiences, which will attract larger audiences, and you get, you know, this positive loop going.
Yeah.
And we will participate in the success of our creators rather than, you know, being in their way of their ultimate success. So that's core to us. And we're basically focusing on the creators of content and experiences as our primary customers. And everything we do is focused on how we can make them more successful.
Yeah. A lot of great points in what you guys are just saying. Having the, I think what's really good about this kind of model is the fact that you guys are going for the long game approach. You're not trying to basically strip mine your kind creators, get as much out of them before they get fed with the system, and then you move on to the next group. You guys are cultivating these content creators, having them set up, become established in Second Life, and in turn if they are successful, they'll attract more people who will hopefully be successful. And again, it's a win-win for everyone involved.
Yeah, and that's why you still see Second Life going extremely strong 13 years in.
Yeah.
You see few games ever having that kind of longevity.
Definitely.
Second Life has many, many years ahead of it as well. So mm-hmm. that's why I think of the gaming industry more like the movie industry. You get some hits, they peak. Some of them you might want to watch, you know, 5-10 years in, but they sort of have a very sort of short, narrow peak and then and sort of have a long tail of over years, whereas Second Life is more like, you know, countries and the world itself, which is, you know, sort of ever going.
Yeah.
And well, at some point you get challenged with some of the technical decisions along the way and you need to sort of, you know, come up with a new platform that makes it easier, faster, and takes advantage of new technologies that maybe the original platform didn't have to deal with. And that's why we're investing so heavily in Project Sansar, to be able to take advantage of these new technologies like VR and be able to take it to yet another level of helping creators have successful businesses and social interaction in virtual space. And so mm-hmm. this is something that we can be doing for a long, long, long time.
Yeah. And that approach to the long-term development, I think, is becoming more and more important, not just for major studios, but also for the independent market as well. We're seeing, as you were just saying, Abby, that a lot of larger studios try to just build themselves around these blockbusters. You know, one very big thing, and then you don't hear anything else from them for, like, several years. But we're seeing, again, with how much the competition has grown in the game industry, that it's important to present yourself as someone that's going to be around for a long time. Again, with Second Life approaching or going over 13 years, that's something we don't see a lot with most developers. Again, they may make a game, they may only get maybe 2-3 years out of it. Very rare. I mean, World of Warcraft, I think, just had its like 14-year or 15-year anniversary of last year. But again, developers going for this long-term success are very rare, yet I think it's becoming more and more vital to sustain the market and sustain these companies these days.
Yeah, and you will have some games, I think, that just has a very really strong longevity. Mm-hmm. You know, they're, you know, like chess, it's still going strong. Mm-hmm. And so you will have some virtual games, whether it will be a League of Legends or a WoW, that can go for a long time because the core dynamic is just something that's appealing to users for a long time. It's not something you tire of or can sort of finish. Mm-hmm. You know, business models that sort of, you know, allow users to consume all the content in, you know, a few days or hours, that's going to be very difficult to be sustainable around that. And creating all that content comes at an incredible high cost. And I liken that more to the sort of movie industry. You spend a lot of money and you hope you get a lot of viewers. And some of them become franchises, like, you know, a Halo or something like that, which is kind of like James Bond or something, where you can continue to churn out sort of new versions that, you know, you can have an audience go along for the long time. And, you know, I'll watch every new James Bond movie that comes out, whether it's good or not, because it's just what you do. And it's kind of the same with some of those games. But yeah, we're not in that space. We're definitely a platform player and definitely thinking long term. So hopefully our longevity is more in the style of like a Facebook or something like that, because it's where people have social connections and they have an extremely strong affinity to the stuff that's in there because it's stuff that they have made, their friends have made, whether it's relationships or content or experiences associated with it. And just a huge variety of different types of experiences that you can do within the platform. You're not just constrained to doing one or two things. You can sort of constantly discover new things by new people. And so it never ends. There's no beginning, middle, end. It's just, you know, forever going.
Yeah. All right. One, I guess, final general question regarding Second Life, and then we'll move on to Blox World. One thing that I'm curious about, and this is going to be a stupid question on my part. Now, obviously, in order to get the most out of Second Life, you need to understand scripting. You also need to understand programming. for people who want to create, let's say, clothing or music, things that are more, I guess, abstract in a sense, how important is it for someone to understand, like, how programming and scripting works on that front in terms of developing content for Second Life?
Well, I mean, Second Life, you don't have to be a scripter to create content. Absolutely not. And I liken it to the physical world. I tend to ask people that sort of talk about how easy it is to create content. In the physical world, how much of the stuff that you're wearing right now did you make?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much?
Not a lot.
How much of the stuff in your home did you make?
I think the same answer there.
Exactly. So, but it is still you, mm-hmm. and it's still your home, because you assembled things in a particular way that makes you feel comfortable and you enjoy that style or theme or functionality that you have on your body and in and around your home, you know, what's basically your private space. And I liken the way content in the virtual space is made in a similar way. You have specialists and know how to do these things, and you end up buying those things or borrowing them or renting them or getting them for free, and then you assemble them in a way that makes it yours. So for most people, it is not required to have really high technical skills to create something that is sort of unique and something that fits with what they enjoy doing. You also have a huge amount of collaboration. Most of the content in Second Life is created by lots of people, not just one person. Mm-hmm. So you have teams that come together where you have the expert scripter, and you have the texturer, and then you have the modeler, and you have the sort of community manager. And so you have all these different unique skills come together and form teams around an experience or a solution or a piece of content. And you also have some people that have figured out, you know, a number of those skills, so they can sort of be a one-man shop. But you oftentimes see collaboration come together. And you also see a lot of interesting experience. And when you start to inspect all the objects in that place, you realize that they didn't create a lot of the content that's in that experience. They went to the specialist. If you want a tree, go to the tree guy. You know, most people won't start creating great trees because it takes skill and time to become really good at it. Just like in the real, in a physical world, you have specialists around different types of components or pieces or chunks of functionality or different types of systems that you then go and partner and collaborate to create the end result that you want.
We also have a lot of creators in Second Life. A number of them start out just as hobbyists, you know, and then learn new skills either from other people or because they're inspired once they sort of get a taste for creating and go out. I mean, I've over the years spoken to a number of very successful fashion designers in Second Life, and a number of them that I've spoken with, you know, when I ask them how they get started, it's like, well, they didn't want to spend the money to go buy a gown from somebody else. They figured they'd try their hand at making it, and the first one was kind of lousy. And they improved their skills, and they started talking with other people and learning, you know, the best way to do things, and now have built an incredible business out of it. So it's we really see creators at sort of all along that spectrum.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the physical world we live in. I mean, no one just starts up any business and just rocks it out of the gate. I mean, you have to learn things along the way, and that's part of the. What makes it interesting for people too is not just figuring out like, oh, I can chop the block and then it's gone, or I can, you know, poke the button and there I get something. It is sort of an infinite scale of how you can improve and learn new things and learn new skills. And that sort of challenge and of constantly being able to improve and learn is part of the attraction as well. It's not something you just can figure it out by reading a manual and then, you know, now you're as skilled as everybody else. No, it takes a skill and effort to be successful, and that makes it more interesting.
Yeah, and that skill and to allow people to get in there and create more content, I think that's a great lead into our final topic, and that's talking more about Blocks World and what it is and how you guys are also allowing content creators to earn money and off of their created stuff. So let's move on and talk a little bit more about Blocks World, and that will probably take us to the end of the cast. For people listening to this cast who haven't heard of Bloxworld yet, could you tell us a little bit about what it is at the moment?
Yeah, so Bloxworld, in spirit, has some similarities because, again, it's a platform for users to create content and share it with other users. And as of last week, also actually be able to profit from the work they do. Why we started Bloxworld was because, A, it's a mobile-first experience. Second Life is a sort of desktop-first experience. Bloxworld has been available for the iPad for a while, and just as of last week, it's also available on the iPhone. And, you know, soon, in not too distant future, you'll also be able to share and play on the web directly through the browser. We're also dealing with a very different demographic. I mean, Second Life is 18 plus, and the amount of skill required to create some, you know, really successful experience of content is pretty high. In Bloxworld, we wanted to be able to be appealing to a much younger audience. The histogram of age in Second Life probably peaks around 9 years old. In Bloxworld, peaks around 9 years old. So we have players from 4 years to, you know, high ages, but sort of peaking around 8, 9, 10 for players, and I would say average maybe 1 year older on the creators of content. And we've made it so that it's a lot easier to create experiences. It's also then obviously quite more limiting in what you can do compared to Second Life. But it's easy for kids to drag and drop blocks and create some really powerful experience of vehicles and being able to tell stories and even be able to create little games where you can, you know, win and lose. Soon you'll be able to, you know, have leaderboards and stuff too, where you can actually compete with within the experiences that the kids create. So to date, I think kids have shared about 2.7 million worlds. And in the marketplace where kids can create models, they've uploaded about 700,000 models that kids, you know, can are selling to other kids. And then when you earn coins through selling your content, yes, you can now, as of last week, ask to redeem the coins you've earned for real money. So you can then go, you know, buy your candy.
So the basic premise is, you know, on iPhone or iPad, a kid can easily create a little three-dimensional world, scene, game by combining these drag and drop 3D blocks, and you can scale them and change the color and add textures. Then you can use what we call action blocks, which are things like wheels, motors, those sorts of things, jet engines. And there's a little visual scripting language where you can combine instructions to say, okay, when I hit the left button, this wheel turns left. Then you can, once you're happy with your creation, you can either save and share that model. You know, let's say I make a car, I can put that model for sale on an in-app marketplace so that users around the world can buy that model for Bloxworld coins. But I can also take that car model I've made and make a whole racetrack for it and a game, and then share that game to the community for any other player around the world to play. And as they play and like that, I can get rewarded with coins that way. So players can earn these Bloxworld coins that they can use either to buy more content in the game, whether it's models other players have made or some building sets that we Linden Lab release. And now, very successful creators who reach certain thresholds are able to redeem their Bloxworld coins for real money.
Okay. So as you're saying, the actual quote-unquote scripting of Bloxworld is more about a visual language compared to a lot more of the harder coding that we see in Second Life. So is there any kind of like transition, like if someone goes from playing Bloxworld, they can't necessarily, you know, jump into Second Life the same way, like, the skills don't really translate, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think conceptually some of the skills translate in that, hey, I can create 3D content, I can get other users to consume and play with my content. I can make money off this content. Yeah, so someday some Blocks World kids will graduate to more mature platforms or more complex platforms like Second Life, or in the future Project Zansar, to continually expand their skill set and find audiences to who wants to consume their content. So it's sort of a similar in spirit, but it's definitely a much more simplified experience that a much younger audience can enjoy
and also learn from and learn from playing around and trial and error. I mean, I as a marketing person, I am not a programmer. I can build something in Blocks World. I can play around with, you know, sequencing commands with the visual scripting tool, and a lot of times it doesn't work, and then I can figure out how to make it work, and there I've learned to think, you know, to think a bit more like a programmer. So
yeah,
if I then took the next step to learn, I would at least have that sort of background.
And there's a lot of other sort of, it's not just the technical skills, it's also how do I create an experience that's interesting to other people? How do I market this?
Yeah.
How do I service this? So there's a lot of other skills that kids can build up that will directly translate to a Second Life or a Project Zansar or many other things in life. Like how do you run a successful business? How do you find out what other users want and don't want? And how do you iterate on what you're doing to become more successful? And those are extremely valuable lessons to almost anything in life. So Blocks World is a really great way for kids to understand how to create something interactive, create something in three dimensions, and understand what aspects of it works and what doesn't work, what other kids enjoy or don't enjoy. And you also get the chance to consume what other kids have done with the tool set and see what other kids are doing, which help challenge you into how can you do something like that and how can you learn from what they've done. So it's an extremely valuable tool for kids to learn the basics of programming, the basics of running a business, the basics of servicing other users.
And just to encourage creativity. I mean, it's at its heart, Blocks World, like Second Life, is a creative platform. And the idea is that players are, you know, encouraged and incentivized now to create whatever they can imagine, try and figure out how to make that work, share it with the world, and then be rewarded when as people like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I think those are very important lessons. Again, as you were saying, especially at a early age, and we're seeing, I guess, a really good example of this kind of philosophy towards getting kids to start learning these valuable skills would be like Super Mario Maker that came out last year. And again, there's not a lot of tools out there for someone who's not a dedicated programmer to start being able to build this content and get these soft skills learned, being able to understand what it means to iterate on a design, what it means to even make something that is interesting, that's unique. These are things that you can't really necessarily, you know, read a book and learn like in a classroom. These are things you have to learn on your own and learn your own repertoire around. So again, something like Super Mario Maker or Blocks World, with being able to teach this at an early age, I think is a very great idea, especially in terms of making the game industry more accessible and more inclusive to a wide range of audience.
Yeah, and there's a lot of tools in the world for, I would say, the developers to create and distribute. So we as a company are targeting what we call creators. Yeah, some of them might be developers, but the idea is not that you have to be a developer. Yeah. So you think about all the complexity that goes into creating a game, distributing that game, and monetizing that. That's a hurdle that's way too high for everybody except for studios and developers. Mm-hmm. And we think that's very unfortunate. So we want to make sure that a much broader base of users can create, share, and profit from what they're doing without having to understand how to run servers, without having to understand how to compile C++ code, without having to understand all those things. So they can just focus on the creative aspect easily with a button, just share that content with others, and then over time get rewarded for their efforts. So that's kind of that's our wheelhouse right there.
Yeah. And it definitely sounds amazing. Again, it's a market that we don't see too many developers go into these days. We're trying to approach development and design for someone who isn't as skilled at programming. Again, with a game like Second Life, with that freedom and that open-endedness, you're able to, you know, basically give them the keys to the castle, in a matter of speaking. But with a title like Bloxx World that's aimed for a younger audience, you need to also come up with a way to present this to someone who may never understand programming, who may never do it again, but who can still be able to put something together and put something together that's actually original and unique to them.
And valuable to others to consume and play with, right?
And as Ebbett mentioned, I mean, with more than 2.5, I think it's more than 2.7 million now, creations made by kids around the world and shared in Bloxx World, I mean, we've just seen incredible degrees of creativity that run the full gamut from, you know, things, you know, from games to stories to models. It's just about everything and anything you can imagine.
Yeah, there's you can get a sense of what kids are into, and they even start their own memes within Bloxx World. And you also hear just really authentic stories from some of the kids about their, you know, things they like and don't like. You know, you'll have some fun scenes, just kids just, you know, telling how they don't like eating broccoli, or to some really sophisticated race car games. So it's a very broad range of fun things. And ultimately, it's the users and the community that sort of decides what's interesting, what's fun, what's popular, and up and up it goes. So yeah, it's just amazing to watch what these kids are able to do.
Yeah, it definitely sounds amazing. So as you were saying a few minutes ago, Bloxx World is going to be set to mobile devices, while Second Life is going to be the console, or I'm sorry, the PC lock-in for like this type of content creation, right?
Yeah, so Second Life is definitely primarily a desktop. There are options for being able to run it on mobile devices as well, and not off directly through us, but the Second Life viewer is actually open source. So there are some options out there for getting on your mobile devices, but it's primarily a desktop solution from us. So Bloxx World is definitely primarily a mobile solution, but we'll soon go to the web as well to make it even easier for kids to just send a URL out to the world to go and play their game, which will be really powerful for the kids to get you know, even more reach in who can play their game. Mm-hmm. And then Project Sansar, which we'll talk about maybe in an upcoming conversation, is actually targeting multiple devices from the get-go. Desktop, HMDs for VR, as well as mobile. And yeah, you have to solve the problem for what is the solution that is, you know, the optimum for each of those devices. But we're definitely targeting Project Sansar to be multi-platform from the ground up.
Interesting. I think also another good decision by you guys is the fact that you are focusing these different platforms on different audiences and different viewerships, so that nothing is like stepping on the toes of another one of your brands. And again, that goes back to like that long-term development that you guys have dedicated to.
Yeah, Bloxx World and Project or Bloxx World and Second Life definitely have quite distinct demographics. Project Sansar, though, will have quite a overlapping demographic with Second Life, and for some maybe older Bloxx World users even there, but that's okay. We rather compete with ourselves than having other people compete with us. So we're just going to continue to find ways to unlock the potential in creators around the world to express themselves and benefit from it.
Great. All right. I know we are running past the hour, so I have a few general questions to wrap up on Bloxx World, and then we will say goodnight for this cast. So the first question, again, going back to what we talked about in the previous section on this podcast regarding monetizing and rewarding content creators. As we said with Second Life, when someone creates content on it, they can sell it, you know, either off the marketplace and they get the full currency. If they sell on, they get 5%, and you guys essentially tax the virtual land they're on as a means of providing the profit to continue supporting the game. with Blocks World, how does the monetary transaction work in terms of how much does someone get paid and how much do you guys earn when someone puts some kind of content up on the title?
So with Blocks World, it's completely free to play. It's completely free to upload as much content as you wish for the world to experience. On Blocks World, it's more of what is the conversion rate between your coins and the fiat currency that you're trading it in for. Right now, we've decided that for 20,000 coins, you get $10. That is something that we will, because we just rolled it out last week, that's something we will play with to understand what is the right exchange rate between coins to dollars to make it of interest to the creators and also make it possible for us to support the game. Now, in Blocks World, there are also blocks that you have to pay for to create with. So we do have income from selling a block. So if you want certain fancy blocks that can do special things, anti-gravity blocks or whatever, you have to pay to get access to those blocks that you can then build interesting models with. When you put that model in the marketplace, the minimum price will be the sum of the blocks that you're using. And then you can charge above and beyond that because of the creativity you put in to create this unique model. So that's kind of how Blocks World works at this point. Yeah.
And that definitely sounds like a wise decision on Linen Lab's part. One of the problems we see with a lot of free-to-play and heavily monetized titles is they go for microtransactions so that you're not really buying something that's yours to keep. You're buying like the chance to use it for maybe 3-4 tries and you gotta pay another dollar or another and so on. But by allowing people to buy these things, it allows, again, to associate value not only to the content that they're buying but to what they're creating. And that just feeds back to talking about empowering the content creators to not only be able to produce something that they want but also feel like they're getting adequately compensated for whatever they create.
Yeah, we're trying to find the right balance between how we monetize the game, but ultimately, ideally, enable the creators to monetize what they do and us sort of share in their success of creating interesting content. We don't want to put too much of these, I would say, in-world monetization techniques for, you have to buy this thing to get to the next level or you have to buy this thing to be more successful. Those kind of, I think, are sneaky ways to steal money from users. And so we're trying to be careful of not going down that path. But because at the core, we want to focus on making creators successful and participate in their success rather than sort of nickel and diming them in various ways. And so, Blocks World is still a fairly new product. We're going to learn as we go along. But again, at the core, we want to make sure that our creators are successful and then for us to participate in their success so that we can be successful together.
Right. And I think that takes me to my last question for Blocks World, at least for this cast. As you were just saying, as of the time of this recording, a week ago is when you put up the option to allow content creators to monetize their content and redeem that currency. Do you see Linen Lab supporting Blocks World for the long term, much in the same way that you guys are doing with Second Life at the moment?
Well, absolutely. With every platform or every product, it takes a while to figure out if you have found that sweet spot of user growth, user success, and success for us to make money on what we're doing. Blocks World is still young enough that, we'll have to see how it plays out. But we're just so encouraged by the incredible creativity and enthusiasm amongst the kids playing or creating on this platform and enjoying each other's creation. So we're going to give it a go for a while, and we're very optimistic. It fits very well with the overall sort of mission of this company. We're really learning a lot by targeting a very different demographic, very different platforms, very different tools for creation. And we're going to be able to leverage those learnings for work we do in other places, because if you can make, you know, 9-year-old successful creators, then you've learned something that can be leveraged for other users as well. We're really excited about the product. And if you look in the App Store, I mean, we're talking like north of 4.5 stars in the App Store rating for this product. The kids really love it. It's really hard for kids to find something that gives them this creative outlet.
Exactly.
We're really optimistic about it.
Definitely. Again, going back to what we were saying a few minutes ago, again, there aren't that many avenues for providing these types of tools and these lessons for children, much less for even adults who, again, may not have the aptitude or the expertise in programming, but who still want to be able to create something interesting, again, create something unique to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a huge gap between what I would say experts and non-experts when it comes to expressing yourself in 3D, interactive 3D experiences, and be able to share those. And we're trying to bring those to a much, much broader audience, because ultimately we believe that the way we will experience content and share it with each other ultimately will be more and more sort of in the third dimension, ultimately with VR, where we can actually, you know, participate with each other in the third dimension in interactive ways. That's going to be so much richer than just, what we're doing now over the phone or the way communicated on, I would say, the sort of the 2D web. So the future is going to have more and more needs for these sort of virtual, three-dimensional, interactive social experiences. And so platforms that allow people to express themselves in that way, just like platforms has enabled people to express themselves with the written word, with photos, with videos, you know, 3D interactive immersive experiences are sort of the ultimate medium that's going to follow the path of those previous, I would say, simpler mediums, so that more and more people can create, share, and benefit from those. And so we love the position we're in, and we love the technology we have and the products we're working on, and it just couldn't be more interesting.
It has definitely been a great cast with both of you tonight. I'm sure we could spend who knows how many more hours talking, but I'm sure you guys have to get going. So we're going to wrap things up for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. To end the cast on, my final question then is, do you have any final thoughts on what we talked about or anything you would like to say to any of your fans who are currently listening to this cast?
I just want people to be aware that if they want to express themselves and be able to share interactive 3D virtual experiences with each other, that, you know, Linden Lab has lots to offer. So come on board, create experiences, create content, share it with the world. And if you're successful, you can make good money doing it. So come on board and join us on the ride.
Awesome. All right, so I think that is a great note to end this cast on. Peter, Emmy, it's been a pleasure talking to you for about the last hour or so. And I would love to have a follow-up cast with you about, specifically about the challenges of creating a digital economy and what goes into it.
Sure. Sounds great.
And good luck with Blox World and Second Life and for your upcoming project as well. I think that will also be great to follow up with you guys on and see what is going to make that so special along with your other titles at Linden Lab.
Yeah, we should definitely talk about Project Sensor in the future as well.
Awesome. So, for those of you listening, we're going to wrap up the cast here. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a guest on the podcast or write a piece for the site, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking that little Patreon banner at the top of the front page, and any donations will be greatly appreciated. Be sure to subscribe both on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer. That way you'll get the latest updates for whenever new posts go up, new podcasts, and of course streams. And last but not least, check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for recorded plays of titles of all kinds, including critical pieces as well as campaign plays of a variety of titles. Again, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will see you all next time. Take care.